Good morning, everyone. This is Agile Apps. We're talking about mobile and native development and what we can do to make it more productive, more efficient, and hopefully more fun for those of us who live in it. I want to start by introducing this panel, give you an idea of who we are, what we've done, and why we think this is important, and then try to run this as open to questions as we can. There's a couple of people out there, so that would be a little bit difficult. There's a Google moderator link up there. If you want to submit questions, I'll try to pay attention, and we'll present the most interesting ones to the panel as we can. So I'm Jonah Williams. I'm coming from Carbon 5, which is a software consulting shop in San Francisco. We do a lot of bootstrapping of early stage companies or products. So I'm coming from a primarily web app development background. And as I entered mobile development work, it was really important to me that I be able to have a process where we could quickly and efficiently show some results and show some value out of the work we were doing on these apps for our clients so that they could actually see some results and make some decisions and change course on what they were doing as early and as often as possible. And I think what I found is that that was surprisingly difficult, and at least there were a bunch of new tools we had to get used to using and some changes we had to make to our process to try to make that work as smoothly and as efficiently as we could. Let me turn it over to Anne.
Hi, my name is Anne Halsall. I'm a product designer at Quora. I'm an interaction designer and front-end developer for both web and iOS. At Quora, I work primarily on mobile, and that is our iPhone app, which is on the store now, and our Android app, which is under development. And before that, I worked on Inkling, which is where I got my feet wet in mobile, rethinking textbooks and educational content for the iPad. I'm a long-time Mac user and a big fan of the iOS platform, and also like to do iOS Cocoa development for fun and profit, so that's my background.
My name is Kyle. I work at GitHub. I'm the director of design there. So I oversee most of our general design direction. I primarily work on the website, but last year I had the opportunity to design our Mac app, and it was an interesting experience, to say the least. So I still do a good bit of OS X design and iOS design and all kinds of various platforms here and there. So we love to worship the ship it squirrel. So it's really awesome to deploy websites really fast, and I kind of wanted to bring that into mobile stuff and native apps and OS X apps and everywhere. And it wasn't so awesome. So that's where I'm at.
But it can be awesome, right?
It can make it awesome. Yes.
Hi, my name is Amanda Wickstead. I'm from Meteor Grove Software, which is a iOS development shop out of Brooklyn, New York. Previously, I was at Zynga, where I worked on all of the mobile games that Zynga did. You may have heard of Farmville, which is shown here. I was the lead developer on that, and I've been doing iOS development since the platform came out. And before that, I was doing other mobile development for other platforms like J2ME. And that's that.
So let's get started with our opinions. I want to ask each of you, what do you think is absolutely essential to being able to iterate quickly on a native app? I mean, mobile or desktop, but what do you absolutely have to have in place? Especially what did you have to find to put in place to be able to make it possible for you to iterate on that product in an efficient way?
I think it's really important to actually, it kind of sounds dumb, but to focus on not what you're building. So we spent a lot of time building tools around the OS X app when we were building. So we have a really good reporting and updating web app that we have that's super easy to send out new releases to users. So instead of going through very complicated build processes, we can actually just tell our campfire robot to make a new build of the app, and he posts it up, updates the version, posts a change log to the website, and it goes out. And I think it's really important to focus on things like that and to focus on the tools around the app that you're building so that there is absolutely no friction to delivering new betas, especially, even if it's only staff-only betas. But I think it's really, really important to completely remove the barrier. I think, you know, a lot of people that are building native apps, they have the exact one person who has taken all the iOS device profiles and, like, building a new thing and distributing it to the team, and that sucks. We built automation around that to make it easier so that anybody can do that. You know, all you have to do is push up new code and tell it to deploy new app, and it pushes it down to everybody's iPhone or their Macs and notifies them of an update. So that would be the one thing that I think is really, really critical to iterating quickly on the apps.
I think, like Kyle said, I have two different things. Like Kyle said, being able to push out builds to your team, beta builds specifically, and having it be either a one-line like command or a button to press, or just having it happen automatically whenever you push to your GitHub server or whatever. Right now, I have a combination of a Jenkins job and that builds my Xcode project, and I use TestFlight to distribute the app to all the people on my beta list. And right now, I have that set to just build automatically whenever I push to GitHub. And the second thing, I think, being able to iterate quickly once the app is in the wild, as we all know, it's pretty difficult to push a new version of your app live with any kind of speed whatsoever because of Apple's App Store requirements. So instead of having the freedom that web developers have to be able to just push code live whenever they want, I kind of go for an approach that's more like everything is server-side driven, like the whole app is data-driven, so that if the code changes on the server, then client-side, all the objects get created with that data instead of relying on built-in logic. And that's kind of, it's easier said than done, and it's very different depending on what kind of app you're building, so you kind of have to find your own way to do that depending on your app.
Yeah, I would really second that, the data-driven approach. That was a big sort of revelation for us, and we started out building a lot of features the way you might expect, like a designer mocks it up and gives it to the engineer who built specifically that. But those things end up not being super reusable, and when it's native code, you can't change it without pushing an update to the App Store. So one example of a way you might change your thinking, which would help you be more agile in your mobile app development, is say you have a feature where a user can upload a picture of themselves to attach to their profile. Well, and instead of approaching that as the user uploads a picture for their profile, try to think of it as a modular activity. That you could maybe pass some parameters into to specify different behavior. So for example, you know, most photo uploading workflows are basically identical. So if you can sort of generalize that and say, okay, well, instead of uploading a picture for your profile, we're going to make it the user uploads a picture, and then we do something with it on the server, and then we send some, you know, report back of the status of that request. Now you can use that for anything, uploading a picture to their profile or uploading a picture for a post or adding a picture to a topic or anything like that, and you never have to write that code again. And you could specify it from the server if you needed to. So that was really helpful for us to start thinking in terms of the app as a framework rather than as a set of features that are sort of static.
So I think what I'm hearing is that the things that you do all the time had better be fast and easy if you have any hope of moving quickly. So on the development side, that means tools around your builds and your testing and your releasing need to make that, it should be automated, it should be easy to do. On the live production side, we should have the same thing around if you change certain attributes of your app all the time, whether it's game balance or content or something else, that should be an easy thing to change, and it's worth building the tools to support that. I want to try to comment on, I think there's a design side aspect too, that I think is really important, or at least that I've found to make a big difference in trying to move quickly, and that was around the fidelity of the interface that you're trying to build. And to I really like native apps and the richness and level of detail that you find in their interactions, particularly touch interactions, but building that out can actually be really expensive. There's a lot of detail to cover. Finding a way to do a low fidelity version of the functional behavior of a feature so that you can test it, even if it's just with the person who designed it, rather than going way in depth to build out a really rich interface, I think it's been a huge win for us because if we can throw something out before sinking a lot of time into trying to polish that interaction, it's a huge time saver.
No, I totally agree. When we were building the Mac app, actually, we spent like the first 3 to 6 months just building. There was no design, which is kind of terrifying, but really there was a lot of complicated parts, right? There's a lot of moving parts that you're going to have bugs with. And what ended up happening is that while they were building up the core of this really ugly functional prototype, it only took us like 2 weeks from the time we finished the design to implement that into that ugly functional prototype. Especially with native apps, since I've noticed there's a lot bigger separation or a lot nicer separation between like the look and feel as to how it's hooked into the logic and the functionality of the code. So it seems to be a lot easier, in my experience at least, to almost do the design and like any of the complicated backend stuff separately. Kind of like you were saying, like, is there a way that we can get something using it first? And maybe while you built out this ugly functional prototype, you realize that you hate this feature that someone was going to spend weeks designing. And so it's really important to, like, I guess, ship stuff as fast as possible, even if it's just a pretty interface that you can use that doesn't work, or if it's an ugly interface that works and just has the functional pieces.
I think that leads into another interesting question, which seems to reflect what people want to hear about. Can you comment on what you see as the phases of your development process? You know, how much upfront design is there and is appropriate on the products that you work on, versus how much of it is a continuous process? Like, what are the, you know, and does it change as you start to release the product? Is it really a consistent iterative cycle, or are there phases worth paying attention to in your workflow?
Having done both pretty heavy upfront development where you literally have designers working in Photoshop for 6 months before anyone touches code, and having built the Core Apps example of an app that we just built it and used it and then changed it and then used it more and changed it, I think that good design tends to be an emergent property of a really agile development process. You can also have really good design when you do a lot of upfront work, but it's riskier because you don't actually know as well the factors that are going to emerge when someone's actually interacting with the software. And as Jonah alluded to, it's pretty difficult to prototype these types of applications. Again, it's not quite as easy on the web where you can sort of hack something together in HTML and JavaScript. It tends to be a pretty big process to sit down and write a bunch of native code. So you want to have some confidence up front that what you're getting into is the right approach. I think that of the two processes, I prefer to build something pretty lo-fi that has the functions that I want the app to have at its core. Building the most important stuff first and then just using that and working on it as I use it and doing that over and over and over again. That has seemed to be, at least in my opinion, the most effective process, and I also have the most confidence that the decisions I'm making as a designer are correct.
I actually, when I was designing the Mac app, it's really weird. It's kind of painful to update assets and make minor changes in native apps. That was the biggest difference to me in web development. Is it's super easy to like tweak a button in HTML and CSS and like change the color of the gradient a little bit or something. But in native code, it tends to be a little bit harder, especially when you start running into performance problems, because it's not so easy to always just render the gradient. Sometimes you want to create an image and it's faster. And then creating an image means it's in Photoshop, which means you have to slice it up and blah, blah, blah. And what I ended up doing is I created kind of these halfway in between things, is that I had my Photoshop comps, and then I wanted to see how it would feel to use it. And what I did is I split it into like two or three layers of just transparent PNGs and used JavaScript to animate them out and like create almost click areas, almost like old school like image map type stuff where it's super easy to like hack together, but it gave me the feel of like when I click this button, this happens. And I think that it's really easy to imagine when you're like heavy in design phase how awesome this like interaction is going to be. And I did that a few times, and like a lot of the interactions that I had where I had things sliding out of this way and that way, it was just dumb and it was like terrible and it made the interface worse. And I realized that way before we had to spend, you know, 2 or 3 weeks implementing it in the app to realize it was a bad idea to back out and go somewhere else. So it's almost like whatever works for you, but I think the core is getting results in front of people as soon as possible. So getting allowing people to use the app, and whether it's like actually a functional app or like prototypes or something, but don't get too pigeonholed in like pure development or pure design or any of that.
And don't get too fussy about custom UI. Like, just wait until the app is like more baked before you start worrying about like custom nav bars and things like that. That stuff becomes expensive to change. And you can use Apple's built-in stuff for prototyping, and it'll take you 5 minutes to write.
I think when you're developing games, you're kind of at a little bit of a disadvantage as opposed to if you're creating just regular like productivity apps or web apps of any kind, because when you're creating a game, you're creating a whole system where each part has to work together in a certain way. So you can't like develop like, you know, the way the character moves across the screen or something without developing the point system or what kind of enemies you're going to have in the game or whatever. It kind of all has to come together at once. You can't release half a game because it's not fun for users. And the only, whereas if you're making a productivity app, you can release like your most core features and then add stuff on later, and that's fine for users. They'll still get a full experience out of it. So with game development, like depending on how complicated of a game it is, it might take anywhere from like 3 months to a year before you even push your app out in front of users. So I guess our industry is a little bit behind the lean startup times, I guess, in that sense.
Well, I think you're being hard on yourself. The game development contracts I've been on, games are hard. I mean, they're inherently a custom UI almost all the time. I do think there's room to, if not release it, to build a minimal version. I think a lot of game shops are getting better at that. Like, what's the absolute least core part of this game we could build first to see if even that's fun, and then start to build it out. I'm actually curious, though, especially in the game development world, where at least I've seen you tend to have like a real asset pipeline of a team of artists producing content for this thing, it can become a very data-driven app, but designing with that in mind seems very tricky. I think it parallels what some of these other products do, right? Where you have an external data source that's going to drive much of what's in the app, whereas if the game, it's an external art team. Well, hopefully not too external, but someone producing a lot of content that you're trying to validate that the app is going to be good when it arrives, but also trying to engineer something that will support that as it comes in.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's just a matter of team management at that point. Let your artists and your developers sit next to each other in the same room so they can agree on things like what file size is okay, how big the assets should be, how many frames of animation they need, stuff like that.
Do you do a lot of shape mock-ups? So instead of waiting for assets and stuff, build out the game with like a square instead of the character, or
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting to me. Like, especially with games, a lot of it depends on the feel, which is a very esoteric idea. And a lot of that is based on a lot of complicated equations of like how fast things move or how gravity moves or how all of this stuff interacts with each other. And it seems, I don't know, that would be very complicated to me. Like tying in both the visual look and feel and then the how it feels part and trying to like balance in between those two. Like, do I need to make this character bigger, like physically on the screen to make him work, or do I just need to change how he moves across the screen?
I think at first glance, if you're playing a game that's made with that's just using programmer art, like squares and circles and line drawings and stuff, at first glance you're like, this game is terrible, even though I haven't played it yet. It just looks awful. So, but once you start playing it just to get a feel for it, like if you're testing out somebody's prototype or something, you can still feel like if the game is good or not, or what the problems are. So you can kind of separate out your artist's tasks, which are obviously going to take a while, from your programmer's tasks.
Yeah, I actually want to tie that back into an example Kyle gave earlier. You were talking about JavaScript-driven demo that's not even functional, right? You're just swapping image layers around. Yeah. You compared it to image maps. We've had some good success with a designer who actually built image maps, right? Mm-hmm. Because you end up with a clickable image that you can put on the device really easily. This was Photoshop created wireframes, but there was no color in this thing at all. It was incredibly bare bones and simple. But even that unstyled, just slightly tappable sort of interface let us learn a lot about whether or not the flow of the app worked well. And it was incredibly cheap to build and test, and it gave you something you could actually touch with your thumb and discover that it's impossible to tap on the little tiny thing that you thought would work, right?
And what Amanda was just saying about, you know, if the game is fun with squares and circles, like, it'll be fun even without the good art. That's true of all products, by the way. I mean, if your product is good, it will be good without gradients and drop shadows. So it actually, I think, can be really good for sort of your app and your process to sort of be forced into this conundrum of, okay, well, it's difficult to do high-fidelity prototypes. Maybe that's a good thing.
No, I totally agree. Like, great design will make your app better, but if you're counting on great design to be the thing that makes your app viable, you've missed something already.
But you do have that thing that Kyle brought up, which is like the end result, the feel of the app is everything in it, including the gradients. And how do you get that to be good? It's kind of an esoteric question, but I think, honestly, there's a little bit of luck involved.
Yeah. So something I noticed was that when you're talking about phases, is that when I look at how we developed this Mac app, it was really funny. There was a huge portion of time building the foundation and the functionality behind it, mostly because we were doing very complicated things like interacting with the file system, which a lot of native apps don't do. But there was that chunk, and then there was kind of a smaller chunk of me doing the visual design of the app and figuring that out. And then implementing that visual design was super quick. I was actually really impressed with how quick that was. But then after we got to that point, which is you have a quote-unquote finished product. You have what you've designed and you have what you've engineered, but now you have it and you have to make it feel right, like we were talking about. And that period between like having a finished product and then really finishing the product was huge and way bigger than I've ever dealt with anything on web stuff. Mostly because a lot of the pages are static or very simple, small parts of the page moving, whereas with native apps, oftentimes you have, it's not like you know, for example, there's no navigation. And so a lot of tiny buttons or tiny icons that do other things or swap things out, and it took a long time to get that final polish, which a little bit of it was iterating on the visual design, a lot of it was iterating on the animations and the structure of it and what pieces felt right. But I was surprised, definitely, how much time it took to polish the app.
But it sounds like that was at least a process you could iterate on, right? Like,
app
was just getting better. It wasn't that anything to show. And
all during that time, we were pushing out betas to staff, and it automatically updated the app, so everybody was using a new version of the app, and we'd push it out, I don't know, a couple times a day or so, a new build. So we got a lot of feedback on that. It just took a lot of time, a lot of development time, a lot more than I would have expected, I think, to update stuff.
Sorry, Anne, you were going to say something.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask, like, at what point do you feel comfortable sweating the small stuff?
It's so hard. It's a weird thing, because I love shipping things, right? It's like the ultimate high is, like, shipping things out to users, especially if you have something awesome. But on the other hand, especially if you're launching a new product or the first release of an app is really almost risky with native stuff, because people will like download the app and go, this is terrible, and like never think about it ever again. Whereas with websites, people end up circling back to apps whether they want to or not. So for GitHub, like people link to github.com all over. But for our Mac app, you have to actively go out and download it. It's not like you ever like click a link and you end up in the Mac app. That doesn't ever happen. So it was a weird thing to see a lot of people still to this day that were like, I downloaded your app, you know, last April and it was buggy, so it's buggy. And I'm like, well, we've actually kind of worked on it for a year. And so that's a really hard thing. It's like, where do you sweat the details and how do you decide to ship? And that's, I don't even have an answer for that.
Well, I have a question from that. It's tying into something the audience is asking here. So when you have an existing, there's a question around what sorts of gain do you actually get from a native app? If you have Quora or GitHub that exists as a web presence, or if you have Farmville as a Facebook game, how much have you actually seen new users come in through providing it on a new platform, or changes in behavior in your existing users? Is this thing really a draw, or is it something to help your product remain sticky with the people already engaged in it?
I think it depends on what kind of business you are. Like if you like for Farmville, for example, users really wanted to be able to interact with their farm when they were away from their computers, which is a lot of the time, but they're never away from their phones. So we thought it was natural to bring it to iOS. For other apps, it might just not be necessary. Like you might just want to make a mobile formatted website instead. For Farmville, it was necessary to make a native version because obviously Flash doesn't run on iOS and JavaScript just wasn't, and I think still isn't quite there yet to handle something like Farmville running in mobile Safari. So if it's necessary, it's necessary. And if it's not, it's not. But then also, it might, for some businesses, you might be launching on mobile only. So in that case, it's not even a question of how many users you're bringing in to your real business or whatever. Your real business might be mobile-based to start with, like Instagram and Path and stuff like that.
I think if you have an existing web product, at least in the case of Quora, I mean, I can even give some numbers, but it is absolutely, absolutely worth it to have native apps, at least in our case. Quora is a knowledge platform, and it's also a social network, so to a degree it kind of fits into mobile in a way that maybe some apps don't. But if you look at things like Facebook's mobile-activated users are 50% more engaged than those that aren't. That's just huge. I mean, it's remarkably huge. Plus, once you're installed on a device, you have so many tools to re-engage users. The app icon is there constantly reminding people that your service exists. You can send push notifications to them to get them to open up the app and re-engage with your service, which is really powerful. But also, you can just fit into those like 3-minute slices of life that people have waiting for a bus or at the doctor's office, where you could never do that in a desktop web application. And for some apps, that's actually like this entirely new way of using the product that can bring a lot of sort of interesting usage cases. The other thing that's really advantageous is that Apple and Google will do marketing for you if you have good apps. So when we get featured by Apple, signups go up 500%, and weekly actives go up 10%, just from being featured on a new and noteworthy list. When we got App of the Week, we got a remarkable amount of new users, and that was just in a 1-week time frame. And this was people who'd never heard of our product, and they weren't necessarily web techie savvy people. Apple's pretty good at reaching normal consumers. And I think that's one thing that mobile development brings that I think web development never really broke into, like the average person. These mobile devices are really accessible. iPads and iPhones and Android phones, they're just useful for people and who don't necessarily have nice computers or understand good browsers or anything like that. So one thing I noticed is that when I released the Quora app, my parents signed up for Quora, my 60-year-old parents, who don't even have Facebook accounts. So I thought that was pretty powerful.
So I want to tie that back into an agile process. I think like the fact that this is a question, and I think it's a common question, suggests to me that it's one of the things that we should make an effort to measure all the time, right? Like, this seems like a big deal. It's an important thing to know. So it should be one of the things that we measure as early as possible. And ideally, something that we test for without building the app, if at all possible, right? It's always, if we can measure it without building it, that's way better than building it and then measuring it and finding out we were wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if these conversions are important, then the app should support a way to measure them and find out which users it's serving and what it's doing for them as part of the process, early in the process, and not be something that we guess at.
So like I was saying, we built a lot of tools around our things, and one of those was taking statistics of how people were using our app. And so for the Mac app specifically, I guess I have a little bit different opinion on a lot of people think you should just have native apps because you should have them, and they should duplicate the functionality everywhere of everything. And I don't really believe in that. I think that you should think about what is good about a native thing. So for the Mac app, I didn't want to duplicate GitHub.com functionality. I didn't want to spend a lot of time on the interface of browsing diffs or commenting on code, because that's all stuff you can do on GitHub.com. What you can't do on GitHub.com is make your commits locally from the code you have on your computer. And how do you get your code from your computer up to GitHub? And that's where I wanted to like bridge that gap right there. And so as far as new users, we actually didn't get that many new users so much, but those users that were using it are using it a ton. So like, you know, we have something like 25,000 people use it actively. And I was looking at some stats, and like it's crazy. Like we have about 700,000 syncs from them in a week, and like something like 200,000 commits are made by these people. So it's not people, it's like people are really using it. And that was our goal, and we were able to measure what those were. And so it's not just, oh, I want to see revenue or paid signups or whatever. It's like, I wanted to build a tool that helped people get their code from their computers up to GitHub. And the stats that I was most interested in is, right, how many people are committing it, how many repositories they have in this app, how many times are they syncing. Like, those are the most interesting things, and we were very careful to measure that so that we can see if they are or not.
So it sounds like you were really able to identify the core of what the app should do and focus on that first. I mean, did all of you have that experience where, because I think for all of us, we're working on products that existed beyond just the mobile app. Is it always can you always extract just like a subset of features that are critical to port, or do you feel like you need to bring over all of the existing functionality onto a new platform for it to be worthwhile?
I think it is important to just pick the subset of actions that your users are going to do on the native mobile app, or you know, when they're not at a computer, or like number one reason, because the screen is so small, like it's just hard to fit in a bunch of functionality, and it's hard to arrange it in a way that it's easy for users to find all the things that you want them to find. So you just want to pick the things that make sense to be on mobile.
I totally agree. I mean, when we launch our iOS app, all it does is browse issues on GitHub. So it's just issue management, and that's it for now. Like we were able to ship that early, or we could have spent, you know, what, it took us 4.5 years to build GitHub to where it is now, and like another 4.5 to build a mobile app, at which point GitHub has moved and like...
Right, and you wouldn't even know if it would be better than what you have right now, right?
Yeah, and so I do think it's really important to pick almost like an easy win to start off with. If you're looking for a native app from a website or an existing product, is pick something that's an easy win. That is, it doesn't have to be your most popular feature, but it has to be the one that makes most sense on the device. So for, you know, our Mac app, we wanted to make sure it was about committing code and pushing it. And for our iOS app, it was all about browsing issues and being able to comment on them quickly. And like, there's zero overlap between those two things because they're totally different devices. And I think that it's, you know, pick the easy win for that thing that is going to make the most impact and start there. And it doesn't mean you can't build stuff later, but...
Yeah.
So something that we've all touched on a little bit, right? We're talking about trying to have a really rapid development cycle, maybe even a rapid design and development cycle. Where does testing fit into that? Like, what do you test? What do you not test? And is it, you know, what's manual? What's automated? Like, where have you found the biggest win there? I can jump on this one if you get
it. Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so as a developer, I have a huge bias towards the tests that make me more productive. So my immediate first concern is always, I want to do test-driven development. I want to have unit and integration tests and functional tests that are largely for my benefit and my confidence in the app. And I want those things to run in a completely automated fashion all the time. Once I get there, I'm pretty happy. There's some pretty good tools now for like driving the UI and validating, or you know, doing regression checks against the UI, making sure the UI still works. I feel like that's a lot less of a win. It's worth doing occasionally. I'm not totally convinced that the in part because it's a lot more effort to build UI driving tests, and I'm not convinced it's necessarily actually gaining us more confidence in the quality of the app, as opposed to just being time consuming and fairly brittle. But I do think go ahead.
Yeah, as a primarily front-end developer, I don't actually have a whole lot of experience with test-driven development. It's notoriously difficult to test UI. So we rely heavily on beta testing, where we actually have people using unreleased versions of the app. And I think just getting those out as often and early as possible is what helps us make sure that we're not introducing UI regressions or things that are broken or that don't work in older versions and things like that. It still slips by, and I really wish there was a better way to do it. Apple does have a framework, at least in iOS, for doing some scripted UI testing, but it only works for native UI elements. So if you're using WebViews, which I think a lot of people end up doing, it's basically impossible to test the UI.
Yeah, I think for me, ideally, my analytics are much of my UI testing, because what I really want to test for in the UI is this UI effective, and are users discovering and using the features that I assume are important. So I either learn that they're not important or that the design is not serving those functions well. And I think the best way to test for that is if I can use user data to do it. Obviously, since our release cycle's not easy, it's often very hard to get those users to do that sort of testing.
Mm-hmm. I was actually really disappointed. This is one of my biggest pet peeves with native development. Coming from the way our website works, everything is awesome. Anytime any commit gets pushed to the GitHub code base, we run a ton of suite of tests. We report back in the campfire immediately, and we spend a lot of time making sure our tests run fast, and our deploys make sure that we're never deploying a broken build. What it does is to me is it removes a lot of what people worry about and why a lot of people end up in long deploy cycles is they're like, oh God, what if we push a bug out? And tests are really good at making you confident that you didn't break something else, or the chances are you probably did break something else, but they get to tell you that immediately. And so to me, it's like we deploy our website 30, 40 times a day on average, and I never, ever worry about it, once. It's never even something that crosses my mind, whereas when we started doing the native stuff, all we have is unit tests for the back-end code, which is really more low-level Git operations. And UI stuff breaks. I don't know. Buttons get misproportionated. Animations go crazy. And I looked into it for Mac development, and there's just nothing right now. For iOS, Square put out a library a while ago called KIF, I think, that used the scripting interaction stuff. And that was the first time I ever saw any real test framework for, at least iOS development, something that was easily, click this button, expect this response, make sure this text is here. And I really wanted that for the Mac stuff, especially because, we've pushed out builds of our Mac that say broken Snow Leopard because we're all online, and how that sucks. That sucks that breaks. And it's because Apple removed some API, and it's because we didn't set up another machine. And that's, I'm a really big fan of removing crap work, and that's crap work. Click through all of these things. And that's something that testing should be doing. That's what we do for our website. We can run our test suite against, seven different types of Ruby immediately and see which ones work. But I can't do that on the Mac. I can't test it on a bunch of different versions of OS X, and that was, going to be honest, very frustrating, especially since WPF, Windows development, is actually really awesome at this. The way they've structured WPF is that you have this view model layer that's very easy to test, and so you can write unit tests against your UI code, basically, and you say, click this button, expect this, and it works really well. And it's frustrating me to see that Mac development isn't like that, because I hate worrying that I can't cut a release, right? That's the worst thing ever.
Fear is awful, right?
It is.
for game development, I've always worked in companies that had a pretty sizable QA department. So it's manual testing done by professional game testers, which I think works the best for the game industry. I haven't done much with unit testing ever, I'm sorry to say. I probably should learn about that stuff, but...
I think there's actually a really sweet spot that is a hybrid of both. Like, I don't want to downplay the importance of a QA department. I just want to shift what they're responsible for. You know, I don't want the QA department doing the crap work that I don't want to do either, right? If we can automate that, we should automate it. And then when we have dedicated QA testers, they can give us really important, useful feedback that can only come from a human using the app and looking at it. And, you know, then the QA bugs become not, well, the app crashed when I pushed this button. The QA report is, well, it's difficult to use this thing, and the screen is now confusing because you move stuff around. Mm-hmm. And that's way more informative. That's where I want to be spending my time and theirs.
Yeah. I guess we're really weird that we don't have a QA department, but the way that we get that same sort of feedback is we kind of forcefully opt in all of our staff into betas and new builds. And so whether you want to or not, you're using these new features, and people, if you just do that, don't say, please opt into our beta. It's just like, no, if you're working for a company, you should be testing out this product and trying out new features and having feedback on it. And so that's where we got the, I guess, the human side of it. Instead of, yeah, I don't like QA departments that have long checklists that they do. I've worked in companies like that before, and they have a spreadsheet of every, like, click this button, look at this, and then you do a new build, and maybe you change, like, some CSS somewhere, and they have to go through this whole checklist again.
Sure.
And it ends up in a way where you have this QA department that's so desperate on process because they missed one bug somewhere here because you did something, that they're doing irrational things. Like, you change the CSS thing, and they're making sure that the image uploads still work. And you're like, no. That's something, I think that's where automated testing really should be focused on, is like, yeah, removing the crap work. The stuff that is easily testable, you know, you can submit an image and make sure that it shows up later.
Sure. And much of QA is acting as a proxy for a user, right? So they make a lot of sense when you can't go to a user to get that data. If you can find a way to actually learn the same things from users who, like, you can afford to let find problems because they're internal or because they're tolerant of that, that's great. And it's probably cheaper. Mm-hmm. Building on how you're testing the app, I think that leads into, well, so when do you want to involve users as part of testing? You know, at some point, you should really probably be testing your product with users. How early are you able to do that? Or is it just on this platform, or, you know, on native platforms, is it almost prohibitively expensive to find a way to distribute something too early to a lot of users?
Why would it be expensive?
Okay, so I've always found gathering a large user base, I always want quantitative metrics of success, which tends to mean I want to release the thing. And in a desktop environment, that's not so bad because you can have a beta program that actually supports a reasonably sized population of people. On mobile apps, it's more of an issue. And on all of them, I think I found my clients a little bit reluctant to do that because they still see the release as a big launch event, and they're very wary of missing the opportunity to be featured as something new and worth paying attention to, even though the feedback they would get from having users use the app is really good. So instead, I've always had to face dealing with a very small subset of users, people that we can bring into a very small beta program, which still gives really good feedback. And you can do really early because you can get pretty forgiving users that way. Even before you have an app built, ideally, if you have one of these prototypes. But I wish I could do more and actually get more data and not have to rely on just a handful of people.
Yeah. You can do... one thing that we did at Inkling, which I'm actually not totally sure Apple lets you get away with this anymore, but you used to be able to do this thing where you could push your app just behind a sign-in wall. And basically, if you wanted to do a limited beta test to more people than you could support with the ad hoc program, which is limited to 100 devices, which is really not enough to get useful quantitative data, you could push your app to the App Store and then only allow people with the credentials to log in to use it. That ends up working pretty well, and it's a good way to test how your app is transmitting its analytics to your server and make sure that's all working before you actually release it publicly to lots of people. The risk is that if you're in any kind of stealth environment or you want to be really careful about who knows what you're working on, your app is going to be public on the store. Even if people can't use it, they'll see that it's there. So that's one approach that we took, and it worked okay. With Quora, we just did ad hoc beta testing and then internal testing, which was okay, but it definitely had that limitation that you're describing where you don't really get useful data from your analytics. It's all just anecdotal, people sending you reports and things like that.
I think, so post-launch, like in order to get more than 100 beta users on the iOS platform, I think people in general need to get over the idea of having a big launch, like it's your birthday or something. It's not like it's. I think for most companies, some like Zynga don't have the luxury of being in the dark. But for most companies, they're startups, especially, you're scrambling for users. You want as many as you can get to learn what they want to do with your app. So just go ahead and launch and. You're not popular yet. Nobody knows who you are, so it's okay to make your mistakes like in the first few weeks or months once you've launched, because still nobody knows who you are. So just launch and collect your analytics.
I don't know. Yeah, I totally echo that. It's one of the things that really frustrates me about our like this culture we have is like this whole secrecy is so important, and like, what if someone gets a screenshot? And like, what if they get a screenshot? I don't know. I'm still gonna launch it when I launch it, but now I get like better feedback. So I would always side on the side of I want more people, more feedback, more useful feedback, because it's really hard to get good beta testers, especially in my experience. I find that a lot of people want new toys rather than to find bugs for you. So they're like, oh, Quora, I love Quora, I want to try the iPhone app, and then it crashes, and they're like, fuck this, and like, throw it away, and you're like, well,
and you get
did you tell me?
Reviews, and they stay there forever, so.
Yeah, but I mean, I would much rather have, you know, screenshots leaked or whatever, and the truth is, like, most people are pretty good humans, and like, I mean, we had people running the beta build of the Mac app for like 3 months or something, and nobody blog, all we did is say, please don't. Yeah. And it was that's all. It wasn't like no contracts, no nothing. And we got people using the app and feedback and got to polish it up to a point so that when we did launch it, it was awesome. And I think that's far more important.
Plus, the thing about screenshots is you actually kind of want your competitors trying to copy your product based on a screenshot. I mean, let them try. It's like trying to bake a cake based on a picture of a cake. They're just going to mess it up, and it's going to be better for you in the end. So it's really not a huge competitive advantage to have a screenshot leak.
I want to bring back user testing. I'm trying to give a concrete example. One thing that we've done that I thought worked pretty well is to try to bring in even a very small number of users on a consistent cycle, whether it's every week or every other week, and always test something with them, even from the very beginning of the project, as soon as we could possibly get away with it. So at the beginning, that's paper prototypes, and we see what we can learn from that. But like getting into the habit of always testing your work with somebody so that you're learning from it seems like a huge win.
Mm-hmm. I'd also say what's really helped me is asking our testers direct questions. Because a lot of times if you say, here's a beta, give me your feedback, they don't do it too much, and then they go silent, and then I'll send them an email and be like, what do you think about this? And then suddenly I get a lot more feedback. If you probe them with specific questions, like, what did you think about creating a new message in this? How did that work?
Speaking of questions, I think we have a couple mics out here, and I think we should take a minute to
excellent
pass them around the audience so the people I've been ignoring can actually demand that we answer their questions. Hopefully.
Perhaps. Any questions? Yes, no? Over there?
I see someone with a hand. Can we get a mic over there?
If we don't have a mic, come running up here. Ask your question. We'll get it answered.
Yeah.
Sure. Sure. So the question was, have any of us done A/B feature testing in live native apps?
Yeah, we have. Our app relies pretty heavily on web views, however. So those are, you know, HTML views that are rendered inside this little web rendering view. So basically, we can do whatever we want on the server side as though it were in a browser, and then, you know, get a sense of what works and what doesn't based on what users do inside that view.
Yeah, I'm sad to say that I haven't done full A/B testing. I've seen incremental feature releases where the feature is available to every user, but because you have some server back data defining what they do, you can only reveal it to a subset of users and see how they respond. But that's more of an incremental rollout than a true A/B test. Although we could probably extend it to have two versions of it. I guess what I would say is I would follow Anne's example and, if at all possible, not make the A/B test require pushing native code out if there's any way that you can help it, so, which I think gets back to part of the value of taking the time and finding a way to build data-driven tools into your workflow as part of your development process.
Yeah. In the past, when I've done A/B testing, so we built a test framework, which is just a really simple class, that a native class on the iPhone app that that contacts our like master test server and says, which group should I be in for test, like main button color or something. And then so both code paths are there in the native app, and then server side, whoever's controlling the test, that person can on the fly switch, like, I want to go from 1% of users to 10% of users seeing the blue button or whatever. So, and then in the next, and after they learn whatever it is they were trying to learn, the next time you push out the app, you take away the code path that didn't work out. So, make it controllable server side is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think if your A/B test is primarily around your visual design, there's a lot of room for pushing down the definition of those views. Either if it's iOS, maybe it's as NIB files. Unfortunately, on Android, you can't push down the XML layouts because they have a pre-compile step, which is kind of too bad. But if you're in a position where you can build that into your workflow, having the ability to pull down new layout definitions and experiment with them seems like it would be a useful way to go about that.
I've never heard of anyone successfully doing that, by the way.
Yeah, I didn't know that was possible on iPhone.
It
Maybe
is
it
if
is.
if you pull them down as some kind of XML-based.
Okay.
But you'd have to design that whole system yourself, and I'm not sure it's worth it.
Yeah, I guess I am hopeful that we'll start to see better tools to make many. I feel like testing has gotten a lot better than it was even a year ago. Hopefully some of these other practices will get better too. And I saw a question out in the... Sure.
What are you currently seeing in approval times from the Apple App Store, and how does that influence the frequency of your releases and what you scope in or out of your releases?
Totally depends on how big the update is and how much you've changed. If it's just a few things or a quick bug fix, it could be less than a day. If it's a big thing that adds lots of features or works with features that they're concerned about, like... security or anything like that, they'll take longer to review it, up to a week. I think they really try to keep it under a week now for updates. And as far as release time, I mean, knowing that it could take as much as a week to get the app reviewed means that we don't try to release updates too often, maybe once every 2 months. Because otherwise we'd be sitting around twiddling our thumbs waiting for approval, you know, 1 month out of, or 1 week out of every month potentially.
I think I work to not scope work around releases. I mean, I want to keep the project in a state where my client can choose to release it at pretty much any point, and then it becomes a question for them to decide when it's reached a point that it's worth submitting a build to Apple and waiting 3 or 4 days to get it onto the store.
You'll always see a usage bump when you release an update because it ends up on the new list, so that's just one thing to think about.
For Anne, over here.
Oh, hi.
As a front-ender, and front-ender can mean so many things these days, so as a front-ender, can you maybe speak to designers and front-end developers in terms of maybe a career path towards mobile, because you know with HTML5 apps, for example, it's really sexy because it's accessible, the opportunity costs are lower. So I mean, can you kind of speak to that in terms of career development and also maybe pitfalls of HTML5 versus benefits of native?
Yeah, it's the opportunities are huge. Mobile's so important right now, and every product pretty much across the technology spectrum is growing in mobile, much faster than in web or desktop. So that's something a lot of investors are thinking about. It's something a lot of companies are thinking about. And if you can position yourself as a mobile expert in your career, that puts you in a pretty good place, and actually that's a really unique skill set. For example, like JavaScript considerations on mobile are almost completely different than they are on the desktop. It's a much more limited computing environment for starters. So there's a lot of things you have to do differently. You can't just naively, you know, dump jQuery in there and then hope it works. jQuery is probably going to be slow. So if you want it to be good, then you have to just know these different considerations. You're also working in a touch-based environment. So if as a designer, you can sort of build your skills working in touch versus mouse and keyboard, then that also can end up being a pretty unique skill set that's extremely marketable.
That seems independent of the technology you're using, too, whether it's native or not, if you're really good at mobile design as a thing.
And mobile is actually just, like, really, really multidisciplinary. And if you want to be good at it, you kind of have to know it all, unfortunately. You just really need to get your hands dirty in the programming environment, and don't be scared of it because it's, you know, Objective-C and not Python or whatever you're used to. Xcode is free on the Mac App Store. Go get it. Start running their sample apps in the simulator. Read the code. You will find that it is not as scary as you think it might be. And now that Apple has this automatic reference counting feature, you don't even really need to worry about memory management. So it's just getting easier and easier, and the frameworks are just remarkably good. So just looking at code is like the most important thing to do so that you don't have this big blind spot when it comes to the technology.
I think there were one or two more. Do we have a mic? Oh, sorry. Yeah. Somebody had I shouldn't call him. Please.
Can you talk a little about how you decide on how many features to get into an iteration or launch? And do you tend towards like little bite-sized features? And how long do these iterations last, whether it's a couple weeks or a month?
Thank you. For our Mac app, I think it's important to... We have two very different types of releases. One is our we actually automatically update our app in the background, much like Chrome does, so it'll automatically update itself as you quit and restart. But we push out bug fixes constantly. So whenever it's useful, if it's going to fix a bug, we'll push out a release. So that kind of stuff happens very often. We can do two or three in a week, or sometimes it'll take a couple weeks to do it. But then what we do is we also have a second release cycle of like 1.0, 1.1, 1.2 that are all big big updates that definitely have to have some kind of new feature, so that the point of that is so that you can blog about it, so that you can have something concrete for all the people that tried out your 1.0 and didn't like it, and now you get to tell them, check out 1.1. I actually did something different, and I think it's important that you do that. And you can actually ship all those new features all the way up to 1.1, but I think that it's important to have that milestone at some point and say, here is the stuff, the high-level stuff that's changed.
I agree. I think I try to do that even internally, where I'll aim for a milestone that's, and this is for my client, not necessarily for a product release, but on like roughly a two-week timescale, and I want every one of those milestones to represent at least a potential release. They can choose not to act on it, not actually ship that one out, but just as a reminder to help you prioritize what work you're doing right now should always be towards being prepared to put the, you know, towards a goal that would allow you to put it in more people's hands and learn something new. I think I would also either pick time or pick features, but don't try to do both. I think it's totally the wrong approach to try to scope work by assuming that you can dictate both the amount done and when it will be finished. I'd much rather build a process where you can measure the speed at which you're delivering those features, set the priorities for all of them, and from that actually have a reasonable belief in when they're likely to be finished. And once you know that, then you can figure out, oh, well, we should probably release on this date because I think the things that I want will be done then. or I'm going to wait until this set of features is ready, or just I need to release on this date, but at least now I have a pretty good idea which features will be done by then and which ones are less likely to make it.
So a lot of these distribution pain points you're talking about on mobile are pretty iOS specific. So I'm wondering why the industry in general isn't looking more towards Android as a leading edge platform.
So on the Android app I've worked on, I think distribution is still painful. It's just painful for a different set of reasons. And in that case, it's painful because distribution, at least the way that project was working, distribution or preparing for it was the moment that we were forced to confront the fragmentation of the market and the hardware that's out there. And so while building a release build was easy, keeping the app in a state where we had high confidence that the app was in a releasable state was not. And then the end result was pretty much the same thing. Whether it was we submit to Apple and we wait for them to tell us it's okay, or we decide that we're ready to release and then we start testing the thing aggressively against a lot of different devices, you're still waiting a couple of days before you're actually comfortable putting that thing out.
Yeah, same for me. The reason I don't want to work in Android is because before the iOS platform came out, when I was working in J2ME, it was sort of the same in a lot of ways as what the Android market is now. There was, for example, I did a project for Nokia many years ago, like 2005, where we were supporting all their handsets from the past, the previous 2 years, and that was about 20 different handsets with all kinds of different screen resolutions and sound capabilities and all this kind of stuff. And then when I was working at Namco a few years later, it wasn't just Nokia devices. It was Samsung, all across the board. We had a room full of 800 different handsets, and we would have to test our apps on all of them. And I don't want to go there again, so I'm not going to.
I think we're going to run out of time. Do we have one more ready? Yeah. Okay, two more.
Sure. If you are pushing out incremental updates every few months, what are you seeing in terms of analytics for how quickly your users move to the latest version, and how thick and long is the long tail of people hanging on to the old versions?
Yeah, I just looked at this as we just did an update. It's the vast majority, maybe 90% update within the first 2 days. Of course, it's extremely difficult to know for sure because you don't know how many installs you have. Apple doesn't give you that information. So you kind of end up guessing based on your active numbers. If your app talks to the server at all, you can basically say out of the people who have opened the app in the past couple days, how many people opened the app, and then you can compare that to your update numbers. But it's pretty high, surprisingly high.
For our Mac app, actually, we keep good track of this, and so that was really important to me to build a good updating system. I kind of hate most the way that most native stuff forces you to re-download and reinstall, so we just do it automatically. And I looked this up, and it's within 2 weeks, about 80% of our user base is on the latest version. And about a month later, it's about 90%, and then it kind of flattens out from there. So the long tail is about, for us, about 10% people, and then the vast majority of everyone else is pretty much always on the latest version.
I don't know if you've noticed this, but that 10%, they never update.
Oh, yeah.
They'll be five versions
behind.
It's
super long tail. Yeah, they're just done.
Yeah.
I think it's important also to have a channel of communication open with your users. Generally, push notifications is a good way to do this. Message them if when you release a new version, if you want them all to update to it. Or email, whatever channel you open with them is good.
So for teams where you're building an app both in Android and iOS, have you found it's better to have a team focus on one versus the other, or to have teams implement the same feature on both platforms?
We have different teams doing it. It seems to work out much better just because you need to be involved in the specific device that you're working on. Like he was talking about, the Android apps are so different. So we have, we just pushed out in the past few months an iOS app for Gauges and an Android app for Gauges. And the iOS app is they're very similar, but they're different in subtle enough ways. The Android app is has a method for displaying on a big screen, because actually Android runs on a lot of like Logitech reviews that you can put on big screen TVs. And I think that when you have separate teams, those people are more interested in what makes that platform awesome. And that's one of those things that makes Android actually really awesome, is that there are all of these types of devices. And you can have an app running on a phone, or you can have it running on a 65-inch plasma, which is not what iOS is, but iOS is like, actually, you have this exact one screen that looks exactly the same everywhere, so you can really focus on making that awesome. So I would always prefer separate teams.
We actually have the same Uber coder writing both our iPhone and Android apps, and the reason for and the reason for that is that we really would like them both to be the same. And we would like them to not share code, that's not feasible, but to, as frameworks, work the same way. And having this the same developer or the same team of developers working on both apps helps us think in terms of the mobile framework rather than iPhone's my baby and I'm going to think about iPhone, or Android's my baby and I'm going to think about that.
So I've worked on projects that have gone both ways. I think what's emerged from that is I'm a big fan of deep expertise, which is tricky because then it's a trade-off between developers with deep expertise in the platform that they're targeting, but also those developers end up with deep expertise in the product that they've built, and it'd be great to have that portable. I think my ultimate takeaway is that I prefer the sequential approach, but where you move from one platform to the next, but it's not about whether the developers are the same or not. It's because I would rather focus entirely on just building the app once for one platform and learning as much as you can from it, instead of building the same feature that nobody wants twice.
Cool.
I think that's it. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you very much.
Come grab us if you have more questions, and once we're out of other people's way.